All right. Good morning, everybody. It's 10:30, and welcome to our new digs here at the Coachella Valley Water District. Mr. Bianco isn't here, so we can't say thank you, but we appreciate them giving us the space and letting us use it. This is going to be a little bit of an experiment. We don't have mics, although there are mics in the ceiling that are recording us, and from what Tom says, they'll pick up a whisper, so don't be whispering things that you don't want the recording to pick up. But it doesn't have a lot of amplification here, so.
Recording yet, Gary?
Yeah.
All my best friends are here.
But we don't have any mics here, so I would appreciate everybody using their big boy voice if they can, or big girl voice, because some of us are a little hard of hearing. And but this does have a little bit better sound than the old room, and we'll be here for a couple of years. It looks like so. On that note, we're calling to order the Coachella Valley Conservation Commission meeting for Thursday, September 11th, 2025. And in recognition of this day, before we do the pledge, I would like to start with a moment of silence. And before we do that, given the events of the last day and the memorial of this day, I have a quote I want to read that I came across last week. Many of you know I was born and raised in Utah, and I was a member of the LDS Church for a number of years, but their president celebrated his 101st birthday the other day. And this was a quote he gave on his birthday. And I think it's very appropriate for today and given the events that we've gone through the last few days. I believe we are all children of a loving God, but no matter your religion or spirituality, recognizing the underlying truth beneath this belief that we all deserve dignity is liberating. It brings emotional, mental, and spiritual equilibrium. And the more you embrace it, the more your anxiety and fear about the future will decrease. Love your neighbor. Treat them with compassion and respect. A century of experience has taught me this with certainty. Anger never persuades, hostility never heals, contention never leads to lasting solutions. Too much of today's public discourse, especially online, fosters enmity instead of empathy. Amen. Please rise, face the flag, we'll have a moment of silence. Thank you. Please join me in saluting our nation's flag. Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the Republic of
Thank you. All right. Do we have any agenda modifications?
We do not.
Seeing none. We'll approve the agenda.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I'm going to do roll call first.
Oh, that. Thank you. Please do a roll call.
City of Cathedral City.
Here.
City of Coachella.
Here.
Coachella Valley Water District. City of Desert Hot Springs.
Present.
Imperial Irrigation District. City of Indian Wells.
Present.
City of Indio. City of La Quinta.
Present.
Mission Springs Water District.
Present.
City of Palm Desert.
Here.
City of Palm Springs.
Here.
City of Rancho Mirage.
Here.
Riverside County District 1.
Here.
Riverside County District 2.
Present.
Riverside County District.
Sorry.
She's present. Riverside County District 3.
Here.
Riverside County District 4.
Here.
Riverside County District 5.
Present.
There we have.
I wanted to be here.
Thank you, and I apologize for that. And I'm glad that the county districts got themselves together and figured out who was which district. So agenda modifications, and we'll continue. Items.
Yes, Chair, we did receive an email comment, Lori Salazar Velasquez from the Fish and Wildlife Biologist Desert Division on agenda item number 7C, and I took a copy of that in front of everyone for them to read. Anybody online?
So noted. Do we have any other public comments?
No, Chair, did not appear.
Seeing none, we'll move on to our consent calendar. Does anybody want to pull anything from the consent calendar?
Adoption.
What's that?
Move adoption.
Move adoption, yes.
Second.
We have a motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? All right, that passes. Now, you have nothing held over from the consent?
Chair, just I know you're moving through this effectively. I did want to introduce for everybody Brian Croft with U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Oh.
He's running the desert division here. And maybe, Brian, you could come up and say hello to everybody.
Sure.
They've been a real important partner to us for a long time. Looking forward to working with Brian.
I don't know if any of you guys worked with Raleigh White, who was our previous office supervisor. He retired, and I moved into that position. There's been a lot of change in our agency over the last several months. So there's been a little bit of shifts in our office boundaries, but we essentially handle all the desert areas of Southern California and Southern Nevada now. So we handle the Coachella Valley MSHCP, Western Riverside MSHCP, and the Clark County MSHCP up in Southern Nevada. So just wanted to introduce myself and put some faces to names and let you know who I am. So if you ever have any questions about Endangered Species Act compliance or issues within those geographic areas, just reach out and let me know.
Thank you, Bob. Thank you. Welcome.
Question.
We look forward to working with you.
Ask question.
Sure.
Brian, are you from the area or are you new to Coachella Valley?
I live in Redlands. I've been in Southern California for 25 years. So I moved here in 2000. I worked for the BLM up in Barstow for a few years. I worked for the Army out at Fort Irwin for a few years doing biological work out there. And then I started with the service in 2004 with the Ventura Fish and Wildlife Office. At that time, the Ventura office handled the Mojave Desert areas. And there's been a bunch of reorganization when the Palm Springs office was established. And I moved over to Palm Springs about 15 years ago. And I've been working on out of that office since then.
If you ever want a tour of a fence that helps protect the bighorn sheep in La Quinta, I'd be happy to do that.
The Linda Evans Memorial Fence.
Kathleen would be with me as well.
We would love
to. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. And again, welcome. We look forward to working with you. And you know that Mr. Ortiz has joined us from the City of Indio, filling in for Hillands. All right. Nothing left over from our previous calendar or from the consent calendar, so we'll launch right into our action items. First up, partnership with our friends at the Mojave Desert Land Trust for seed collection and preservation. Patrick.
Thanks y'all for having me. My name is Patrick Emblidge. I am the Plant Conservation Program Manager at Mojave Desert Land Trust. I lead our native plant restoration nursery and our seed bank. And so what I'd like to do here today is kind of just really briefly talk about desert flora, the value to our ecosystems and to us, some of the seed banking work that we're already doing as the Mojave Desert Seed Bank, and to talk about our proposed partnership with CVCC to expand our reach and collect seeds from more taxa for conservation work. So I'm from the Mojave Desert Land Trust, where our mission is protecting California's Mojave and Colorado desert ecosystems for their natural, cultural, and scenic resource values. And the Mojave Desert Seed Bank, it contributes to this mission by preserving the flora of these deserts. The flora is the foundation of these ecosystems. And so that's really how we start meeting our mission at MDLT. Our goal at the seed bank is to conserve the flora of the warm deserts of California. Our long-term goal is all taxa in conservation collections. We also provide seed material for restoration projects across the region as well. And we're trying to expand on that work. We distribute seeds from the seed bank for reintroduction of extirpated species, for restoration, and for research. So just a brief intro to the flora of our desert region. There's about 2,800 species native to the Mojave and Colorado deserts in California, which is about 30% of California's flora. Our area is about 25% of the state of California, so that's a disproportionately high biodiversity that our service area covers. And a lot of these species are endemic. They don't occur anywhere else in the world, just in our California deserts. And so this flora, like I said, is the foundation of the ecosystems. It provides nutrition and shelter for other plants, insects, wildlife, provides ecosystem services, nutrient cycling, erosion control, and also provides a ton of benefits to humans, cultural values, aesthetic values, just the beauty that we see when we're out in the desert. But this flora and our ecosystems are under threat from climate change, from development, and from introduced species and altered fire regimes. And our ecosystems aren't adapted to this kind of disturbance. So when disturbances do occur, restoration actions are needed. Restoration is most effective when it uses locally adapted plant material and quickly following a disturbance. But that native plant material is not available in the quantity that's needed for this work in our region across the state. There's a national native seed strategy and a California native seed strategy. And both of those identify that there is a lack of native seed available for our current restoration needs, not even considering the future restoration needs that we'll have. And one solution to the lack of native seed availability is regional seed banks that collect, process, and properly store native seed, so it's ready to use when disturbance happens. And so I'll really quickly talk about the life cycle of a seed in the soil seed bank. So seeds are waiting in the soil, dormant until they experience the ideal conditions for germination. They germinate, they grow. Our flowering plants will flower. They need to be pollinated. Once pollinated, they'll develop seeds, and then they'll disperse back into the native seed bank to start that cycle all over again. And so what we do in a seed bank is we support the natural seed cycle by intervening between the natural dispersal stage and when they go back and when they're in the soil seed bank germinating, producing the next generation. So the work that we do at the Mojave Desert Seed Bank is we start by scouting our properties and our partner organization properties that we work on, identifying what species are present, where there's large enough populations to take a good collection, to identify the right timing for making our collections. And then we go out and we collect seed when it's at its natural dispersal state. So it's most ripe, it's ready to go back into the soil seed bank. So we collect it, we bring it back to our lab, we dry it, we process it, clean all the chaff, all the plant material, and so we just have clean seeds. Then we store it in refrigerated storage, which slows down the metabolism, keeps those seeds alive for as long as possible so that they are still viable and ready to be used on the landscape when a need arises. And since this proposal is to collect seeds from CVCC lands, I wanted to talk a little bit about our seed collection ethic. We always we pretty much always go collect less than 10% of the available seed in the year. Seed's really important on the landscape, and we don't want to cause any damage to the existing ecosystem. We want to leave material so that the next generation of plants are there, but also enough seed so that we, so it's available for carnivorous birds and mammals. We also take collections across the population. So we need to have large populations and collect from as many individuals as possible to make sure that we're collecting the genetic diversity. And so that genetic diversity is going to be really helpful when restoration need arises, so that there's just that variability in the plants that are produced. We don't recollect from parcels, from species in an area, from populations within 5 years. So after we make a collection, we don't touch that population for at least 5 years to make sure that there's enough seeds and regenerating populations, generations for that species. We always make sure we properly ID the plants we're collecting from. We take herbarium vouchers, or we take a little plant, press it in a on blotter paper, and then we preserve that so we can always confirm later. And we collect a lot of metadata about the population, how many individuals we took from, any pests or damage, or what associated species were around that population. And we have a database, so we always have that metadata associated with those collections. And we also practice leave no trace ethics. We want to have as minimal impact on the land as possible, but also be able to support restoration in other areas with this material. So we're trying to strike a really conservative balance. And so the benefits of expanding our collection area to CVCC lands is that we will have more collections from this region that are locally adapted to this region that can be used in restoration projects in the future to make sure that they are as successful as possible. And the other benefit is to have those conservation collections in long-term storage in our seed bank, so that it's just a last resort insurance policy for as many species across the region as possible. And so I just wanted to really quickly show our service area. This is the Mojave and Colorado deserts in California, and the black line across the middle is separating the two deserts. And the darker the red, the more collections we have from that 10-kilometer pixel on this map. So you can see we have a lot of collections fairly close to here. Since we're based in Joshua Tree, that's where most of our collections are from. But we're in the Mojave. Colorado Desert has a lot of species that we don't have. So expanding our reach into this area would be really beneficial to increase the number of taxa that we're able to collect from. And that's not my slide. That's my presentation.
Right. Thank you. Anybody have any questions?
Yes.
Yes, Joe.
What is the amount of seed that is necessary per species?
So a good collection is our target is 50 individuals and 10,000 seeds from the population. And so that is a good conservation collection that encompasses the genetic diversity of that population. But obviously, maybe not obviously, that's not enough seeds to use on a large scale restoration project. So what we would normally do is take those smaller conservation collections and then grow them out at a small, medium, commercial scale to make seeds more widely available for bigger restoration projects.
And my other question is, what species are at a greater risk?
All of them. Good. Most of these impacts that we're seeing are nonspecific. It's just affecting the desert. It's it's hotter. One obvious example is Joshua trees. They are not adapted to fire. So when it's a big fire, it wipes them out. But also their seed remains viable in the soil seed bank for a very short period. So by collecting that seed, storing it in refrigerated storage, we're able to extend the lifespan of that seed to decades. And then so we have that material that's available to go back out on the landscape.
Supervisor?
Yeah, I'm just real quick. This is fascinating. And those two, I guess, plants that you showed here in a slide, they're beautiful plants. What are those?
Let's see.
You know, very beginning.
Yeah. So we had
that one.
Well, that one was Claret Cup.
The other one before that.
Before this.
You might have answered this question already, but is there a specific or certain seeds that you're trying to work with? And is there a specific target areas?
We have two main goals. One is to conserve the entire flora. So any taxa that we don't have in our seed bank is something that we would like, just so we have conservation collection of every species. We also look at lists of species that people regularly use for restoration projects, and we focus on those. So the early successional species and the really dominant ones. So creosote, white birch sage, cheesebush, globe mallow are really common restoration species, but good restoration has a really wide, uses a diversity of plants. Tortoise diet consists of, I think, over 100 different species. So good restoration really uses a wide variety of species.
I noticed that in the beginning, you had a slide where we had, maybe hundreds, maybe thousands of solar panels. How does that play a role in obviously seed collecting, and is that an area you're looking at as well? Or,
well, so the solar fields, they wipe out everything that's there. So, and they only have a 20 to 30 year life span, I believe. And so those areas either need to be rebuilt as new facilities or restored when they're done. And that's just to show the scale of the habitat loss and the restoration need. There's large solar farms going up in the Antelope Valley, and those are really affecting Joshua trees, and they're having to remove tons of Joshua trees. So we also have a permit with CDFNW to collect Joshua tree seeds to preserve that species in particular as well.
Can they transplant the Joshua trees?
Can, yes. But there's a pretty rigorous debate on how and when to do it. Joshua trees are reliant on the yucca moth. That's the only species that pollinates them. So if you move Joshua trees, you have to move yucca moths, and you need to be able to understand what the impact is. Also, if you're moving them to a place where they don't currently exist, you're kind of taking them out of the ecological context that they evolved in. But there are organizations doing research on translocation, but CDFNW doesn't always require it for mitigation for development.
Mayor Hernandez.
Thank you. I appreciate the enlightenment about our surrounding desert parkers. Great. In terms of our area and what we're tasked with, how are we going to track sentinels? Have we identified areas that need restoration in the Coachella Valley? And how do we get some metrics to understand that long-term that these efforts are paying off here for the CVCC?
I don't know what the restoration need immediately is in this region, but this is more of a proactive project so that we have the material when it's needed. We like I said, we track all of the metadata about our collections. So we'll be able to report what we collected, how much, and have those resources available.
Mayor Hernandez, probably the question was probably for our team is more so than Patrick, and might even relate a little bit to Lynn's presentations coming up next. So she might be able to address some of those questions.
I think for us, it's important that we understand, you know, what our methodology is going to be, our costs associated with this. I'm all for it, right? But we have a lot of visitors that come here and take advantage of our beautiful desert. And
Austin. Yeah, in the city of Indio and also in the Energy and Sustainability Committee, we've been having some conversations up on how to use native plants throughout our urban landscape and how that could be helpful either to restoration efforts or to the wildlife. Can you speak a little bit about the benefits of native planting in urban areas?
Yeah, so that's really where our program started. When MDLT moved into our headquarters in Joshua Tree, we moved into an old nursery. And so that was kind of the start of this project was growing native plants for the community to plant in their yards and landscapes too. One of our biggest goals is to provide connected habitat between protected areas, and by incorporating native species into our landscapes, even if they're in urban areas, we're able to support pollinators really easily, and other wildlife that are able to tolerate those conditions as well, I think.
Just on average, when you do go restore, what does that look like, and what is success? Like, what's the cost of its success?
We don't do much of the restoration. We provide the material for the contractors that are doing it. Usually it will, you know, this work and these materials take a lot of effort and investment to have. And so it depends on size of cost is going to depend on the size of the project and what species they want in what format.
So who sponsors the contractors?
Perhaps KD is probably give you a little perspective on what we're doing in terms of restoration.
Sure, just to answer your question, like, we have a number of different restoration issues. I'm pretty loud though. We have a number of restoration needs as it is that are incorporating, like, with OHV tracts that we see across our lands, the compaction of soils, and a number of invasive species projects where we've been removed the invasive species and we need to replant the native species. We've been working quite a bit with the Living Desert on starting propagating some of our native plants in our area and collections. But with the Mojave Desert Land Trust, they would just be providing a library basically of collections off of our lands so that if we needed to go forward with restoration in the future, we would have those provided. For instance, a few years back, we had North Shore Ranch where we had a Prop 1 grant where we were supposed to restore mesquite to a particular area in North Shore Ranch. The only place we could find the mesquite was Mojave Desert Land Trust, and we only found 8 of them as individuals. So having a library that we can go to and basically say, you know, we need this many of this species is something that we're trying to incorporate into our cooperative agreement with the Living Desert as well, and kind of do a grow out maybe at North Shore Ranch, but we don't currently have the infrastructure for that. So this agreement with Mojave Desert Land Trust would give us the ability to have that. And there's no cost to the agreement. The MOU is just for them to collect.
Right. One more thing.
Yeah, and I just wanted to point out as well that the water conservation part of native landscaping is extremely important, right? We see a lot of our water use go into outdoor landscaping. And with these native plants, they're already evolved, adapted. To a very low water use. And so if we want to have water for agriculture, if we want to have water for the restoration at the Salton Sea, it's going to be extremely important that we reduce our water use. And this is a very efficient way of doing that in our communities here. Thanks.
Thank you. Any further questions?
If
that, we have a recommendation to authorize the executive director to execute an MOU with MDLT for seed collection through number 28. I have a motion.
So moved.
Approved.
Second.
Yep. So there we go. All right. You get that?
Second. You got a motion. Was my second?
You can do District 2.
Okay.
All right. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes. Thank you both very much. Next item, another presentation from our longtime friend, Dr. Sweet. Good to see you again.
If I can use this. All right. How's this if I just try to project into the mic? Is that okay? Okay. Oh, Mr. Chair and committee, thank you for having me. Glad to be here today to talk about a little bit about climate resiliency within the plan area. So I'm Lynn Sweet. I work for UC Riverside with the Center for Conservation Biology. That's my department at UCR. We are based in Palm Desert. All my employees all live here in the desert. We're based out of, you know, the desert, which is great to be really familiar with, you know, the issues we're facing here. So, you know, I work with a team of about eight, about five or so work on the plan. Okay, so yeah, so this presentation is going to cover a little bit about a climate resiliency project that was funded via CDFW, via a LAG grant. And I'd like to acknowledge Katie for helping develop this project to look at the climate vulnerability of covered species within the plan. But first, I'm going to talk about, you know, why we're looking at climate resiliency for the covered species. This is an image you might have seen before, and some of you might have been at the California's fourth assessment rollout a few years ago. California's working on the fifth assessment coming up, but this is a graphic from the fourth assessment. So this shows the annual average temperature in the inland deserts. This was our regional report, running back 1960 and projected out to 2100. Again, this is the report from a few years ago. So you can see a wide variety and an increase in annual average maximum temperature with various climate scenarios. At the time, they were using a low emission scenario of 4.5, is that blue line. We see a less of an increase in maximum temperature, but the RCP 8.5 is the sort of business as usual scarier scenario where we might end up with higher temperatures. Recognize that, you know, climate change is a heavy topic on kind of a heavy day already, but hopefully this presentation I'll talk about the resilience of our desert species, our covered species, and some ways that CBCC is moving to help mitigate these concerns like these. So this is a little bit about the fifth assessment. I'm working on the inland regional report with Dr. Francesca Hopkins at UCR. So I wrote the biodiversity section for it. So that's in review right now, but this is the timeline. So that should be coming out around 2026 is at least when they will be the end of engagement. So hopefully those will be out at that time. I'll be in, excuse me, the regional report. So there's a link for the state assessment. You could just Google California fifth assessment. And then our inland regional report has a web link. You can't really read it, but it's inland deserts climate assessment.com. So that was developed by Dr. Hopkins and her assistants to look at our inland region. And that's, oh, of course, just to point out, that's the California Governor's Land Use and Climate Change Innovation Office. It's developing that. All right, so one of the things that we might be facing with climate change, I can't discuss all of the topic right now, but be happy to maybe get a speaker in the future for to go more in depth. But just an overview is, again, we might see increases in temperatures throughout the desert. We also might see an increase in variability with precipitation. So climatologists aren't really sure whether we might in the desert see an increase in precipitation in rainfall or a decrease. That's a really hard thing for them to target due to ocean currents, El Nino, cloud layers, all those things that interplay. However, we do know that we have some of the biggest variation in water year to year in precipitation than many other areas in the US. So we're already we have a huge variation. So you can see this is Indio. It's looking at, for instance, winter precipitation. You can see that go up and down and up and down year to year. So we have a huge amount of variability year to year. Of course, we had the tropical storm 2023 that gave us an increase in summer rain. So a lot of variability, and climatologists are predicting an increase in that variability. With warmer temperatures, you basically get an increased ability to dry out and an increased ability to hold and then pour rain on the landscape as precipitation. So unfortunately, we might be looking at an increase in that climate whiplash year to year, drought, flood, so. So that's sort of an overview of the type of effects we might see of climate change. Of course, we saw that a couple of years ago with Tropical Storm Hillary. This is one of our long-term monitoring plots for the fringe-toed lizard out in the Coachella Valley National Wildlife Refuge in Palm Desert. So we have the 2023 photo there and then the spring 2024 photo there. So you can see that landscape was really scoured. So these are some of the, again, the effects we might see with an increase in that variability in precipitation. We might have that habitat really fluctuate year to year. So that's an example for the fringe-toed lizard. So back to the, you know, this project was about looking at how the existing plan boundaries, conserved lands encompass the present and future habitat for the covered species. And the idea was to start with a few species and see what kind of information we get and potentially look at other species for the commission. So one that's near and dear to our heart is Coachella Valley Milk Vetch. This one, we created some maps where we have areas where the species is that's a core habitat area for the species. Of course, I hope you're oriented to this map by now, but you know, the center, sort of the center of the valley, and then we have conserved areas around. So core habitat's dark green, present. The species might be present in the other areas and therefore is conserved as part of those conservation missions for those conserved areas, and then other habitat that they may have. So that's a look at the potential habitat of Coachella Valley Milk Vetch, but really focuses on its habitat is primarily found in the desert sands in DHS and in North Palm Springs and the west end of the valley, and then into the east end in the dunes. So the species, we have a sand compaction going low to high on this graph. Basically, low sand compaction is sort of fluffy sand. Fluffy sand is where Coachella Valley Milk Vetch really thrives. It needs the seeds to be what's called scarified, which the movement of sand really helps it sort of wear off the seed coat and be able to germinate. That's sort of why. So that's just a comparison of a Coachella Valley Milk Vetch, highest at those low sand compaction and then dropping off where you have higher and higher sand compaction. Or like I showed you that graphic of the, you know, scoured silt habitat. That's really not great for the species. So, all right. So then we also created, so part of climate vulnerability for any species has to do with like ability to adapt and ability to disperse. This, what we're looking at, is just primarily where the species could occur if the climate was right. So ignoring all the other factors, it might adapt, it might disperse, just thinking about where it could occur. So present time on the upper left, is where the species occurs in the present time. And then we go through panels showing 2040, 2060, and then to 2080. So what we did is we used various scenarios. I'm showing the moderate scenario, the medium scenario, from the newest set of climate models to just, you know, project what might happen in terms of the covered area, again in pink, and then where the habitat might be in the sort of green color here. So we do see a, you know, a restriction in habitat, partially due to that this one is focused on sand. So it's, so species, you're talking about which species are more vulnerable. Those are the species that might need a specific soil type, for instance, that might be more vulnerable. So this is one of those, it's potentially more vulnerable. There we go. All right, next species, Little San Bernardino Mountains Linanthus. This is one of the covered species that occurs in the sandy flats of Desert Hot Springs, North Palm Springs. This one is near and dear to my heart. It's a very tiny one. But this is an annual species, so it comes up and, you know, dies and sets seed every year. And actually, in some years, it doesn't come up at all because it's very picky about rainfall. Here it is. Here's the distribution that we know about. Again, core habitats in green. Also extends into the white area that's not covered by the plan as well. And then we have this. This is Katie Barrow is actually doing a little volunteering for us in the Sandy Flats and Snow Creek area to look for the species. So this is a small species with a little bit of a restricted range in the plan area. It's an annual plant. So this species, what's interesting is that due to partnerships with other organizations, we actually found more records for the species to the north. So this species, again, in the present time, has that distribution in green and blue there. And then it sort of moves, even if we lose habitat within the plan area, as things heat up, we might actually retain habitat further to the north. So the species is able to move, that's good news for the species. So for instance, if MDLT has partials they're conserving to the north, that's good news. So for the Mecca aster, this is our species that occurs in the east end of the valley, our special monument object for the Chuckwalla National Monument. This is a perennial species, so it's a shrub, small shrub that occurs in those really neat canyons in the monument Mecca Hills. So let's look at the core habitat there on the graphic, really pretty flower. I hope I didn't lose a slide. I have assessed that eight-year-olds are not a threat to the species within Chuckwalla. So they do occur, you know, usually along the sides of drainages and up in the canyons. But yeah, he was just having some fun. But it does occur in the National Monument. So that will function to help conserve the species. And then if you look at this species, interestingly, we see from present, 2040, 2060, 2080, we really see maybe a shift in habitat to the southeast, but not a huge decrease maybe overall. So again, this is, we used a single climate scenario, mid-range, but this is just an estimate, but that looks good. So maybe a little bit of a contraction to the east. This species might be more of a generalist, so to be determined, but that's maybe good news for that species. Then we have Orocopia sage, which occurs in the Orocopia Hills and mountains to the east. This is a perennial shrub. It's a really neat mint family plant. We've done surveys for this for quite a few years, increasingly going into the upper elevations where we found it on the very top of the Orocopia Mountains. So we did a paper about that in Madronio a couple of years ago, but you can see Scott Heacock's there surveying plants way up at high elevation. I think those guys have out there, well, at the desk. So this is a look at this species. I will say this gave us all pause when we looked at this. So you have the present, you know, present day up to the upper left, and you see where the species is really kind of constricted already. We do think this is restricted to certain soil types and geology. And unfortunately, when climate changes on top of that, we might see the species have a lot of trouble. So this is one that you might think about having partnerships to seed bank the species and to try to mitigate, you know, what could happen. Again, this is one scenario. And then overall, we made some graphics that hopefully will be helpful in the report form for you. And this is looking at the different climate scenarios, this red, blue, and beige there, and just time on the x-axis. So from present into later years, and the amount of habitat we predict the species might occur in over time. So for the Stragalus, lentiginosus, the CB milkfetch, we might see a contraction. Xyloriza cognata, the Mecca aster, maybe just like a shift. And this is very generalized. Linanthus maculatus, the little Linanthus, contraction and a shift. If it's salvia, we really might see a huge contraction. So again, things to know about the possibilities and to be prepared. Lastly, Mojave Desert tortoise, which is present, you know, in various places within the Coachella Valley. Multiple species plant. Also, interestingly, in the south of Palm Springs, in Boyd Deep Canyon at the UC Reserve, there are some populations of tortoises there that are being studied. So that's kind of cool. So we have, again, Mojave Desert tortoise there. It's the southern kind of range extent of the species, this species over here on the west side of the Colorado. So that, you know, should give us, it's an important place to conserve its habitat. We made a model again for that species that's in review for a peer review right now, but it's present, you can see present day and up to later in the century. So this was fortunately optimistic as to where it could occur, sort of shifting, you know, shifting northeast, shifting into the Mojave Desert Range more so. Unfortunately, this species also already impacted by various other factors, roads and all sorts of factors. So it's a little bit under threat overall, but hopefully we can keep conserving the area that it might be in, desert tortoise linkage area in particular, within the plan. So again, it's hard to summarize all of the different varied findings, but the point is, you know, we have varied vulnerability to climate change overall with these species. Again, decreasing suitability at lower elevations is a theme. A lot of our species, this is like the hottest and driest place they occur. So efforts like seed banking help conserve those like really hot, dry adapted populations, which is great. So decreasing, you know, suitability at lower elevations and northward contraction, eastward shift. So again, we can create various models to look at possibilities. And then we can also think about, again, positive things we can do to mitigate these. These are basically straight from my report. And then I went to put pictures to them and I realized that we had pictures of various projects here that we're doing already. So again, monitoring. So maybe some of the species, all we can do is monitor. So we keep track of them. So monitoring, barrier reduction. This is a photo of folks working on the I-10 connectivity project that you undertook to look at connectivity under the I-10. Habitat restoration, again, working with partners like NELC to make sure habitats are restored and cleaned up. A protection of refugia, which this is an example of where in Joshua Tree National Park, they have a strategy to put out fires, especially in areas that might be future climate, future suitable climate area for Joshua trees. So protection of those areas that are going to stay suitable in the future. And then again, also assisted migration. So seed banking species, and maybe you can put them in a new place, or seed banking species and restoring. So those are ways that could, again, help mitigate these potential impacts. Okay. All right, so just funding and support, I'd like to recognize CDCC and the original funder of the project, CDFW, for this work. And I'm available, you can get me at lynnsweet@ucr.edu, and I'm happy to take any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Sweet. Presentation showing how our multi-species habitat program works here. I couldn't help but thinking, looking at those little teeny flowers and picturing our seed bank guys trying to... I don't know how you find seeds on those.
Microscope, I think.
they can't be visible to the naked eye, which are at least not mine. Do we have any questions for Dr. Sweet?
No, moved. One quick question. In the very first graph or slide you showed, that showed temperature data from 1960 to 2100. Mm-hmm. How was that data being collected?
So I didn't produce that graphic. That was part of the fourth assessment for climate change. So I'd have to check back at their methodology. But my guess is it was probably a statewide summary of weather station data. But yeah, I'd have to look at the report for specifics. I imagine they're doing their best work on the next assessment. And also feel free, again, to look at the methodology for that online and see if you have any comment. They're still developing that assessment.
Pro tem, if I might, I was kind of surprised that not everybody focused mostly on that slide and nothing else. And it's one of the things we've used in various grant applications for extreme heat monies is taking a look at these assessments. And the disquieting news about these assessments, of course, is that we live in the hottest place in the state, one of the hottest places on the planet. And the prediction is our rate of change is higher than everywhere else in the state too. So not only are we hottest, but we're going to get the greatest difference in heat change. And so the work that we're doing here is important. And the work we're doing for another species called Homo sapiens is also important, thinking about shade trees like the city of Coachella and others have. These are really critical things as we face increased heat and certainly variability and precipitation as well.
On that point, I think as a region, right, there's been a lot of conversation about dust. And so you can see the data right now that's showing heat precipitation and the change in climate is leading to a problem for the Homo sapien. Yep. And so it's just interesting to kind of connect the dots with nature and then basically.
Anything else? This is just a report, so thank you, Dr. Tweet. You don't have to take any action on this. Our next item is a life exchange between East Indio Hills Conservation Area and the Dothan Conservation Area. One of the key components of our multi-species habitat planners, we don't often see these. So, Peter.
Okay. Yes, thank you. Good morning, Honorable Chair, members of the Commission. I believe this is actually the first like exchange we're seeing through to completion since plan implementation back in 2008. So without further ado, I'll get started. This, as many of you know, the CVMSHCP was delineated its conservation areas to contain the highest quality habitat for our covered species. However, habitat nonetheless exists outside of these conservation areas, and this external habitat can be utilized to reconfigure our conservation area boundaries through what we call the like exchange process. Like exchanges can be proposed by permittees when they have high priority development projects that have inherent inconsistencies with conservation objectives. And what I mean by inherent inconsistencies are things that include lack of authorized disturbance and infrastructure that exceeds certain design requirements. I do want to emphasize that like exchanges are an option of last resort. These are not something that you should be doing because you want to build a house in a conservation area and you want to try to see if you can get your parcel outside the conservation area. These are really, you know, a matter of, like I said, last resort. So that brings us to the like exchanging question. The city of Coachella is currently reviewing the KPC specific plan that takes place over here in the undeveloped portion north of I-10 on the eastern part of the city. The city also happens to overlap out there on the west, the East Indio Hills Conservation Area, and out there on the east, the Desert Tortoise and Linkage. So the KPC development is just nicking the tail end of the East Indio Hills Conservation Area. As part of that development, the KPC plan is proposing an extension of Vista del Norte through East Indio Hills to provide a secondary means of access. This is required for various safety reasons. And as part of this build out, it's going to be a 4-lane roadway with an 80-foot right-of-way, and it will require significant earthworks to get this road up and over both the Coachella Canal and the levees that are protecting the canal from, you know, various other impacts. So the widening of Vista del Norte was not accounted for during the original planning process, which means it does not have any take allocated for it within the plan, doesn't have any sort of specific mitigation measures to accommodate this widening. For roadways that are not considered covered activities, these are generally limited to 2 travel lanes and a 74-foot right-of-way, which means that this road is inherently inconsistent with our plan. And the reason that we have those requirements for these uncovered roadways is just to maintain biological connectivity across these roads. It's far easier for many of our small mammals to cross these less trafficked, narrower roads unimpeded than it is for these larger facilities. Even accounting for the design inconsistencies, given the earthwork, the extensioning, the widening of this road, the city of Coachella just does not have enough take allocated to it within this conservation area to build this facility out. They're fairly limited given the amount of habitat in this area to really, for most of these cases, 1 acre of disturbance. And this project would have direct impacts that exceeded that 1 acre. So they just couldn't design the project to make that math work out. We did bring this to our attention. And unfortunately, the developer, after doing some digging, could not redesign the roadway to accommodate those more narrow design parameters, nor could they reroute the road anywhere else to avoid these conservation areas, just given where the project is on the landscape. So the city worked with the developer to propose a like exchange, whereby they're going to remove the southern 62 acres of the East Indio Hills and have found instead 100 acres adjacent to the Dos Palmas Conservation Area. So these parcels exceed the acres of habitat impacted by the extension of a widening Vista del Norte. The habitat present on these parcels exhibits fewer edge effects, constitutes larger habitat patches, and provides improved landscape connectivity compared to the habitat being removed from East Indio Hills. One thing I also want to note is that it contains a swath of mesquite hummocks, both on this property and kind of running through again into the conservation area. As many of you are aware, mesquite hummocks are a critical conservation priority under the CVMSHCP. So CVCC staff is particularly keen about this resource that we're going to be conserving through this like exchange. So the like exchange was approved by the wildlife agencies in January 25, 2025, by the city of Coachella in February 2025, and by the county of Riverside in March 2025. So pending adoption by this body, CVCC will initiate the process to take title to these properties and revise the conservation area boundaries for future reference. Management of these properties would be folded into our standard monitoring and management activities. Here you see we already have plenty of land in the area that's going to be taking us down there regardless, so it's pretty close to what we're already doing. With that, the recommendation is before you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
We have any questions for Peter? Thank you. This is one of the key components that makes the local beach habitat plant work. I haven't had to use it in quite a while, but it does offer that balance that we so need between both development and conservation effort. Since this is important to the city of Coachella, Mayor, do you have anything you want to add?
Yeah, no, I think I've been here and part of this commission for 19 since the beginning, but
the plan was always intended to be a development plan. And so if we color within, you know, the developable area, we're okay. And there are mechanisms within this plan that allow us to do this like exchange. So I think it's a difficult process, you know, but it's one that you can achieve your goals of seeing development and at the same time conserve and bring in other areas into the conservation that meets our goal overall.
I'm going to make a motion.
Oh, thank you. Stephanie, do you have since you're...
Nothing, Chair.
Okay, well said. And I think, you know, you're absolutely right. So we have a resolution before us. We have a motion.
Well, let the mayor make the motion.
Yeah, we'll approve.
All right.
Second.
All right. You get that? All right. All in favor?
Say
aye. Any opposed? Mm-hmm. Any abstention? Nope. Motion passes. Thank you very much, Peter. And we're moving on. Local development mitigation fee nexus study update. This is you, so you don't get to sit down.
Yeah, no rest for the weary, huh? Okay, so I don't have any slides for this. I couldn't figure out how to make this visually exciting. So you'll just have to listen to me drawing for a little bit. So the local development mitigation fee is a development impact fee assessed on all development within the CVMSHCP area that disturbs habitat. It's assessed at two land use designations, commercial industrial rate per acre, and a dwelling unit per acre rate that encourages denser, more compact housing development. The LDMF was anticipated by the original planning documents to serve as the primary source of acquisition funding and would be supplemented by agency mitigation funds provided by CVAG, CVWD, IID for some of their infrastructure improvements throughout the plan area. Like all development impact fees, the LDMF requires a nexus study connecting impact from growth to the cost of regional improvements. And within the context of the CVMSHCP, the capital improvement that this fee is funding is our entire reserve system. So the most recent nexus study was conducted in 2011 and it was based on land values determined in 2010. That nexus resulted in an assessment of $5,150 per acre, and subsequent inflationary adjustments have resulted in a fee today of $7,635 per acre. So that's the commercial industrial rate that some of your city developers might see. A few other key changes.
How much has it brought in?
It has brought in to date around $32 million as of the close of fiscal year 24. Two key changes from that 2011 Nexus study versus the original planning documents. It extended the acquisition period to assemble our reserve from 30 years to 45 years in acknowledgement of some slower rates of development that we were observing at the time and continue to observe. And it also allocated a portion of our LDMF, which is originally intended for acquisition, to monitoring and management. And that was to compensate for the collapse of the Eagle Mountain landfill project that had originally intended to provide a lot of that management dollars. All right, so the 2011 Nexus study grouped conservation areas into priority areas and secondary areas. And at the time had identified that purchase prices within the priority areas were gonna run around $9,600. Purchase prices per acre. Purchase prices in the secondary areas were gonna run around $1,500 per acre. Recent internal review by CVCC staff suggests that acquisition costs for these priority areas is actually going to be closer to $15,000 per acre. The plus side, I guess, to that is that we actually are expecting the secondary areas to run a little bit cheaper than anticipated at $1,000 per acre. So a little bit of savings there. Nonetheless, these higher acquisition costs suggest that we need to update our market study and revise our Nexus report to ensure that the CVMSHCP can meet its reserve system assembly goals. So CVCC staff issued a request for proposals to update the land valuations and the LDMF Nexus study in June 2025. And after a six-week advertisement, we received two proposals, one from BAE Urban Economics and one from Economic and Planning Systems Incorporated, hereafter referred to as EPS. The review committee consisted of staff from CVCC, City of Palm Desert, and the Desert Valley Builders Association to conduct reviews of the proposals as well as interviews for both respondents. After review and interviews, EPS demonstrated that they had extensive experience in financial planning for MSHCPs both within the state and across the country and were ultimately selected to update the CVMSHCP's LDMF. Incidentally, EPS is also serving as the primary entity updating the TUMF impact fee under CVAG's TPPS project as a subcontractor to the primary body there. And so we're looking forward to identifying opportunities to streamline both the stakeholder engagement and hopefully fee implementation across both agencies. Similarly, the delivery schedule is going to mirror the TUMF update, and we're anticipating having a revised Nexus study to bring before this committee for additional review in April 2026. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Peter, good job with that. Looking forward to seeing what the final review of that is. You know, we're going to have to, we've talked many times, just how we're purchasing land versus our monitoring and maintenance and all of that. So that'll all be coming before us in the next year. Is that you, Stephen, that had a question?
Yeah, just last TUMP or last DIF update on this, you mentioned that we extended the purchasing time or the period and then also accounted for loss of revenue with Keith. Are we going to do that again?
That is one of the tasks in the study, is to assess whether those assumptions hold true and to identify, you know, do we need to extend more time or do we need to alter the proportion of funds from LDMF that are being allocated to the management and monitoring expenditures.
And I mentioned that because if I remember correctly, and looking at how much we've acquired over time, I think we are exceeding our projections in terms of how much land we've been bringing in.
We're actually right on cue with our conservation efforts. But what we are exceeding is the amount of conservation we've done in relation to the amount of development that's taken place. So, you know, we're way ahead what we call our rough step parameters, right? So from that perspective, you know, we're doing very well.
I only bring this up because, and I'm glad that you've included the DVBA, because they were the ones last time that put a lot of pressure on the pocket logs, because we bored. But Tom was really good. I mean, you extended the time, and that was a way to kind of meet our goals as well. So I'm just trying to understand and prepare ourselves, as I'm sure we'll lobby again.
Yeah, and we'll see how the analysis bears out. I don't expect the fee to go up significantly, as you heard on land prices. You know, even after 15 years, while some of lands go up, the vast majority may actually go down. So we'll see how this plays out. I think really addressing the management monitoring gap funding is going to be the big item. And it's a part of the perhaps irony in all this. In order for us to do more out there in terms of conservation, developers have to build more. And you know, the more development in non-conservation areas means we have more funding to protect those conservation areas. And development just has not kept pace. And for all the talk about the Coachella Valley growing, it has not kept pace with even your colleagues' districts in Western Riverside County. We're off pace compared to much of the Inland Empire, and it's certainly affecting our budget.
Unless so, we are actually building more than years.
Any other question?
Just one. What does this cost compared to? I don't remember what we approved for the TUMP study.
This is approximately $50,000 more than the TUMP study to accommodate for the land valuation that we've also asked them to do. So the TUMP study was a subtask, the larger TPPS, right? And I think that was about $130,000. This is about $180,000. One step four.
It'll be good to have the land value.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Not, then we'll take a motion.
Approval.
Second. A motion and a second. Did you get that? All right. All in your favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Thank you. And our last item, election of our CVCC officers. Mr. Kirk.
Yeah, we do this, of course, every year, the first meeting of the fiscal year. Your current officers, of course, are Mr. Gardner and Ms. Holmes is the vice chair. Is there a motion or a yes?
I would like to go ahead and nominate the team that we have in place. I think they did a good job.
I second that.
And we have at least one nomination for Mr. Gardner. Do we have any others
for consideration.
And Elaine for vice.
Is this a
petition
slate?
The slate. The slate. Well, you take it over from here. You have a motion, a second for the slate. Hearing no other considerations.
And Elaine is interested, is that correct?
Yeah, Elaine wants to continue, and
perfect.
I would like to continue as well. So do I have any other nominations? Hearing none, we have a motion. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
You opposed? Motion passes. Thank you very much. I am honored by your support, and I really appreciate the opportunity to be able to chair this great organization. It is very meaningful to all of us, and I appreciate your continued support. We have some information items. I don't know if we need to go into any of the reports on that. I would have you take a look at item number G, the illegal dumping one. The maps in that are really illuminating, and it shows both the amount of debris and dumping going on in unincorporated Riverside County and Desert Hot Springs seem to be the most affected areas, and but we're making some headway on that, and it's good to see. So hopefully we can adjust those fees to get more money for monitoring and maintenance. We can tackle even more of that. And there's nothing else on our agenda. Our next meeting, do we have any more public comments?
Sure.
I don't say, go ahead.
I would like to suggest, and at least let's talk about, especially on the heels of some of the reports we've had, that we take a look at a suggested plant palette, not to mandate those nurseries and other entities that sell plants, but to suggest and inform people what are the most beneficial plants that we should be planting. And can we look at that? Can this body put together a plant list that we can provide those entities and that will serve us as we go forward? And I'd like this body to
take a look and think about that. I think that's a great suggestion. I think we'll loop in Mr. Ortiz and his gang.
While we do that, would you talk to CBWD? They have an excellent pamphlet that does exactly what the mayor has suggested. Maybe we could put our name on it and take credit.
You know what that's called? R&D, which is rip off and duplicate.
Yeah, I think CBWD's is more on the drought tolerance side at Friends, which is my
real job.
And then we've worked together with MDLT, the California Native Plant Society, and Coachella Valley Mountains Conservancy. We've developed a book that's the Native Planting Guide. And so that is available on the Friends website. And we also have some hard copies there available for cities to take. Any questions that you guys ever have on that, happy to help on that end.
I'm glad we have that in place. Now, what I suggest, though, is that we get it to nurseries, we get it to plant outlets, so that they can just say to people who are looking, here's some recommended. I'm not suggesting we mandate.
Right.
I am suggesting we educate, inform, and give them the opportunity to do the right thing.
It's a good idea.
And I also think it should include a list of things that we know are invasive,
absolutely,
non-eating plants. So that people are educated about that as well.
It's in there.
I believe that
Springs has one as well, don't you?
So, yeah. You do, in partnership with CBWD.
Well, with a new fee, we're going to have plenty of money so we can do it.
Why don't we talk to
Let's check very quickly. As we mentioned, you were coming. Now, we've come a long way, but yet it's in cycles. You know, we do have a task force that was created as a result of it. And a relationship with, for example, the tribal governments has only grown and increased and advanced, especially when we're talking about Torres Martinez. But nonetheless, though, it's just an ongoing effort. It doesn't end. And I'm just hoping that maybe one day we could actually think it through. Obviously, not only for county, but for our cities, in which we do see these areas that are illegal, that are dumped illegally to another level where they're very, very high, for example, in the county area and the east end. But, you know, we do have sheriff, we do have code, we do have fire, we do have other groups that are playing a role. in our school districts. Remember, at one point in time, folks, we also had mulch. We also had, you know, debris from landscapers, and which were going into certain areas, and which had the fires. And if you notice, the fires have gone down quite a bit because of that reason. But it's a good point. We need to obviously concentrate a little bit more on it, quite a bit, quite frankly. And, you know, hopefully it doesn't get any worse, but it does seem to be going in cycles. Thank you.
Our next meeting will be Thursday, November 13th, 10:30 here in this room. If nobody has any other comments, we'll adjourn. Thank you, everybody.